For $99 a month, INE's new All Access Pass subscription plan allows IT professionals to expand their skill set and stay up to date with the latest industry developments and information available. Visit INE.com/packetpushers today and start training for your dream career. INE.com/packetpushers. Today's episode is brought to you in part by ExtraHop. Think analytics, folks. ExtraHop is the enterprise cyber analytics company delivering performance and security from the inside out. More on ExtraHop later in the show, but if you just can't wait, visit extrahop.com/packetpushers to find out more. Welcome to Heavy Networking. Joining us is William Collins, who raised his hand when we asked for folks who wanted to be a guest on the show to volunteer. William volunteered, and here he is, and we're going to discuss hybrid cloud networking today. And you're like, hybrid, what does that even mean, hybrid cloud networking? We're going to get into all of that. It's something that the vast majority of the audience, I think, is going to face at one point or another. If you're not facing it now, you're going to be facing it in the next few months or years. And the issue gets down to routing complexity to a greater or lesser degree. I've heard this conversation, had this conversation with a number of different folks about the difficulty of routing in hybrid cloud. No one operating public cloud networks had making the network engineer's life easier right at the top of their list when they came up with things like ExpressRoute and VPCs and so on. So anyway, we're going to get on to that with William here. So William, welcome to Heavy Networking. And let's start by introducing you. This is the first time you've been on the Packet Pushers Network, I believe. So in a sentence or two, hey, man, who are you and what do you do?
Hello, my name is William, and I'm a lead cloud architect in healthcare, although I probably do more on the network and security side at this point, but yeah, kind of a little bit of everything.
So you work for a healthcare company and you're at the tip of the spear for cloud networking, it sounds like.
On the bleeding edge, sir.
The bleeding edge, and there has been some bleeding, is that so we're to understand?
Yeah, well, that's normal. That's business as usual with, you know, getting into cloud, right? A lot of learning. Trial by fire.
We said hybrid cloud networking here for this bleeding edge trial by fire and so on. And hybrid cloud can mean a few different things depending on which marketing person's behind it and, you know, which analyst is writing about it and so on. So for this conversation, can you define how you mean hybrid cloud?
Sure. I would say kind of looking at like my single environment, like looking through a lens and, you know, that environment now being comprised of more than just my traditional data centers, branch and campus. So I'm including and mixing other things, like maybe for this conversation, maybe a few public cloud providers, maybe a private cloud provider. I don't know. My traditional data centers, maybe I have one, maybe I have four, and maybe some for a lot of the high performance cloud connectivity. And using something like a physical direct connect, you have to have some sort of interconnection services in the middle, you know, to facilitate that. So, you know, maybe talk a little bit about that.
So the general idea is you're talking about establishing connectivity between some resource you own or control in a data center or whatever to some kind of public instance, a public cloud or a SaaS service or whatever.
Correct.
Okay. That's good to know, because hybrid cloud and multi-cloud and all these terms are being thrown around. And I know I myself am having a hard time keeping track of it. So it's good to establish terms.
Yeah, I think multi-cloud is kind of just thrown in the mix as a given at this point, because who's not multi-cloud right now? It's right. Definitely the hip thing to do.
Now, are you consuming compute resources for your on-premises facilities, like in your data centers? Are you consuming them in a cloud style?
Yeah, we doing a lot of a mixture of a little bit of everything.
So you've essentially built out what I would consider a private cloud environment inside your own data center where you can scale resources up and down as needed and so on and allow people to consume them more easily.
So I think the way that this, like the way that that sort of started out was, you know, having, you know, especially when Azure Stack became a little bit easier to consume for like an enterprise. Mm-hmm. So I think the idea was to utilize Azure Stack and get that sort of experience, development, and procedural stuff built and put together before moving up into the public cloud itself, for the idea of like cost optimization and things of that nature. But I think just in my experience, we've slowly just shifted from doing that to just public cloud.
Okay. So you made an initial investment into Azure Stack as a almost like prototyping to kind of get the feel for it and the impact operations and so on. But then have migrated those into just regular old Azure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It would have been interesting if you'd gone out and built the Azure Stack big. I would have loved to drill into why you would have or wouldn't have done that, because I know it's a big financial commitment off the front end just to get in there.
Yeah. And it's a lot more work, I think, than, you know, if you're thinking about getting in and doing that, it's a lot more work than it sounds at the onset.
Well, talk to us about strategy here with hybrid cloud. I asked this in the context of some of the companies I've talked to about what their strategy is. It is represented to me by the technical people I tend to interact with more as they basically told us in the C-suite that we need to go to cloud. And so we're picking up VMs and throwing them in the cloud as fast as we can, because it's the only thing we can figure out how to do and keep these people happy. So it doesn't really sound like there's a strategy. I mean, that's not a strategy, really. That's, you know, someone yelling at you and you reacting to it. So when you're dealing with hybrid cloud, how do you form a strategy? What is your strategy, William?
So just to, like, at the onset, you know, I'm not a statistician or, you know, I'm not here to, I don't have any numbers in front of me, but if you go out and you look at numbers, if you look at like what the research outfits are saying, or like tech professionals, maybe like independent surveys, the results are pretty high on, you know, folks considering or already having adopted hybrid cloud in some way or another. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, a lot of them want to take that a step further and say, okay, you know, within the next 2 to 5 years, the general direction is that applications and systems are going to be, you know, cloud-based, you know, so that's a pretty big shift in traditional, just like our traditional practices is, you know, network practitioners, security practitioners, you know, folks that have lived in the data center doing things that way for so long, you know, because in the past you have, if you take like Cisco or like VMware, you know, they sort of have these like validated designs that like in the past, maybe you would use that or some sort of variation of it really. And, you know, that's your data center for the next 8 years with, you know, little pieces thrown together to keep it going, you know, upgrades, you know, code upgrades and whatnot. But when you look at like hybrid cloud as a strategy, I don't think there's not a single strategy.
Yeah, there's no one vendor that can provide you with the, you know, the reference design that you can follow to make this thing go.
Yeah, it depends on your business. What does your business do? How does it use and consume services? How do your customers consume your services? So I think like when I started thinking about hybrid cloud more in general strategy, I try to break it down into like simple pieces, like how are all these disparate environments actually connected? Since cloud native architecture is like so different from what we are used to, mm-hmm. you know, how are these things connected? So if I have traditional data centers and I want to use colos, for instance, how are my traditional data centers connected to those colos? How does diversity work? You know, how are those colos, you know, how are the on-ramps set up to the cloud? You know, what else am I using? You know, we're still delivering, I guess, the same applications and services, yet maybe we're doing it with different technologies and that are completely different terminologies and applied with different methods and, you know, using different life cycles. It's just kind of a everything changes sort of thing.
So was there a measured or an imperative that came down from the top that said, we're moving into the cloud, here's a roadmap, let's start fleshing it out and deciding how we're going to approach this? Or was it more like, oh, some developers threw some compute into AWS and now we have a hybrid cloud strategy?
You know, that's funny. That's a good question, because I've been in three different fairly substantial cloud environments, I guess. One of them was sort of on the smaller side, one maybe kind of medium, and then one, you know, fairly large. And in each one of them, I think it was sort of the same thing is, you know, cloud is a big thing. And, you know, this is the next thing for application delivery. You know, we can deliver services faster. We have the access to the features we need. You know, it's going to make us more efficient. And, you know, in your market that you're competing in, you know, whoever gets those features out to your consumers quicker. You know, whoever has a nicer, shinier, easier thing to use is gonna win. So yeah, it's each situation I've been in has been sort of the, okay, we have a, you know, for our enterprise, we already have some sort of B2B land-to-land process available. So we don't have to go through a lot of red tape. We can, you know, simply set up a single VPN up to a cloud provider and there we go. You know, we have private, we're routable, you know, and we can get going, you know, until such a time that your application, you know, I've actually had it happen where this was like sort of the situation. And next thing we know, nobody knew this, but an application that was up in the cloud was henceforth production and was relied upon by the majority of an organization as one of probably in the top 10 critical applications on a single VPN.
I think we can get to some a very specific point here, because as you've been describing this, I've been asking myself what is different about cloud, where so many times I hear this story, you know, something got put up in the cloud, it just kind of happened, we were now made aware of it, oh my gosh, it's production and we have to live with this thing. And as I think about, like, historically pre-cloud era, projects would go through this very rigorous planning stage. And there was a lot of work with vendors to create a bill of materials. And there were delivery dates and there were expectations of what the project was going to do. And there was a lot of, you know, conference calls and things that went into this whole project, whatever the big project was. And if you could anchor it all into one thing, it was tied to spend. Well, I mean, I guess we could zoom out a little bit and say that there was a business need that was defined, but then ultimately it came down to what is this thing going to cost? And the planning was very rigorous because there was so much money tied to whatever this project was going to be that you couldn't afford to not plan. You couldn't afford to not design deeply. So here's my question, William. Has something changed here with cloud where, because it's so easy to get started and kind of get, you know, begin delivering services on cloud, that design's kind of fallen by the wayside?
That's a good question. I think that part of that is, so with, like, if you look back at just application delivery in general, application delivery has evolved so much. And it's sort of like a lot of these new things will hit like the hyperscale level first, and then, you know, enterprises will slowly start consuming them and, you know, baking them into their environment. So as you hit like more agile, and then, you know, DevOps becomes a thing, and you know, don't even try to define DevOps, but for what it means for a lot of people is, you know, that this, whatever it is, this new service, this new project, this new thing that we, you know, the new journey we're embarking on because of DevOps, it's going to be quicker and it's going to be automated. A lot of things are lumped into those categories. So as it relates to cloud, there's like levels of like cloud maturity. So maybe at the beginning of your journey, you had a like maybe a single application or product team that wanted to get into cloud to enable their, you know, whatever it is that they're working on. But as it evolves and more people start consuming, then, you know, maybe you actually build a cloud team. Maybe you have a cloud platform team, you know, or maybe a new vertical in your organization. Like maybe you have, you know, network engineering, systems engineering, you know, cloud engineering, and you know, the more reliance on cloud, the more governance, the more, you know, representation you need from the networking folks, from the cloud folks. And that's where building that maturity out and making it is like the day two stuff goes. You all have had a lot of cool guests on that podcast, but, you know, day two is huge. So what is your operational readiness for cloud? You know, how does that look compared to all of your operational readiness stuff that your organization has already etched out? You know, because in the beginning, it's very easy to, you know, say that someone sets up a VPN to a cloud provider and there's no cloud governance within that cloud provider. We'll say that somebody just slaps on a public IP on an instance or a VM and, you know, allows traffic to come in, and they're, you know, SSHing from, you know, the public library into Azure and then into the data center. You know, that's probably something that's happened to a lot of people, you know, because it's easy. And if there's no governance surrounding any of that, then, you know, that's something you can run into.
That's really funny you bring up the cloud governance. We just recorded for Day 2 Cloud a show on cloud governance that, as this show on Heavy Networking is published, won't have yet come out on Day 2 Cloud, but it is coming out within the next few weeks. So in that show, we dive into... It ended up being a discussion about guardrails. You know, what? How do you put guardrails in place so that people can't just go up and do things willy-nilly that all of a sudden make it very difficult to support, or that there is very little design and so the system doesn't scale properly or doesn't have the proper security or whatever it is? Putting those guardrails in place and having that cloud governance makes all of that go away. Well, makes all that go away. Okay, I made that sound super easy, but, you know... At least you've got a template to be working from and a system that can enforce everybody's playing off the same sheet of music, so to speak. Well-made point, William. Okay, so in the beginning of this show, William, we promised to be talking about hybrid cloud networking. We've been talking about hybrid cloud more broadly and some of the problems it represents. So let's dive into the hybrid cloud routing challenges. Now, you mentioned, okay, I might have my local data centers. Maybe I've got some stuff in a colo and I've got some stuff in public cloud. And along the way, I slapped up a VPN tunnel, or maybe I built a circuit out between the colo and public cloud and so on. Can you get, I guess that's kind of a high level of some of the options that are there, but let's compartmentalize this. Let's give us some more of the options from your viewpoint of how I should be thinking about connecting public cloud to my local data center. And I guess we need to throw colo into that mix as well. What are the pros and cons? When is a VPN or an IPsec tunnel a good solution versus a bad solution, et cetera? Let's get your thoughts here.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, the VPN is usually the first way that this is approached. And I mean, that's just because it's quick, easy, cost effective. It's, there's no additional hardware spend or, anything else that you have to look at from the spending aspect or internal processes. You know, all that's probably already in place. But I would say that the difference is traffic is encrypted, obviously, because it goes through the internet. But with encryption, that means throughput limitations, maybe, and having the available hardware in the data center for that encryption. So depending on your strategy, if you're going all in on cloud and you're gonna start migrating applications up to the cloud, or you're gonna lift and shift whatever you're gonna be doing, that might not scale as well as you'd like it to.
In other words, I might need more bandwidth than I can get on one end or the other of this thing, depending on how much encryption I need. Is that the point you're making?
Yep.
Yeah, and there's a couple other points there, I think, too, William, right? Where we've got the tunnel endpoint on the one end that we control is probably some piece of hardware, a router that can encrypt up to how much did I spend on the hardware, or license it for. And then on the other end, in the cloud, where the termination point, I think, matters too, if it's a VM sitting in the cloud, you're getting different throughput than if you're terminating to some cloud-native construct, as I understand. Does that ring a bell with you?
Yeah. And I mean, that almost goes back to strategy too, because, a lot of times, like once your cloud platform is more, organized and you begin developing a strategy, maybe they say, hey, we want to only use cloud native things in the cloud. So when I say cloud native, versus maybe cloud based, I mean like a construct that has been born in the cloud and is designed specifically, exclusively for a cloud from day one. So like when I say maybe like a Palo Alto firewall or an F5 load balancer, sticking that in the cloud, is that really cloud native? I mean, in my opinion, it's not. An Azure load balancer would be cloud native. An Azure, web app firewall might be cloud native, but, an F5, I don't think is cloud native. So
I understand. Maybe I don't understand. What is why would I want to lean or consider leaning more toward a quote unquote cloud native construct, a firewall that Amazon or Azure is providing me, as opposed to just putting a Palo Alto, which I'm familiar with, in a VM inside a VPC and using that as my termination point? What am I getting by going cloud native?
you know, there's a lot of opinions in this space, and then there is facts and there's evidence.
And, you know, so facts and evidence.
But at the end of the day, a lot of what you will hear is, okay, you know, Microsoft maybe put together all of these constructs within this ecosystem, and they work really well together. They're tested really well together. They're intended to be used together. When you're injecting something externally into this happy ecosystem, maybe you're also injecting additional potential problems, or you know, you begin to have to do the care and feeding for different aspects of something. You know, there's additional overhead. Maybe something doesn't play right with Terraform. Maybe it doesn't have a provider, and that throws off your CI/CD stuff or your, you know, infrastructure as code. So there's a lot of aspects to that that could be said.
Can you dig into that a little more? Are you saying that thinking about CI/CD and DevOps, and it feels like developers are driving the show here, that I, as a network engineer, need to start to align how I do things more along the CI/CD or DevOps methodology, meaning I'm going to want to have those cloud native constructs because they're going to tie into a DevOps or CI/CD workflow nicer than just a virtualized instance of whatever I'm used to working with?
Yeah, I mean, I think those things are absolutely critical. So as a network practitioner, you're going to slowly shift from, you know, using the Office suite to manage all your stuff to, you know, writing your documentation maybe in Markdown. You know, maybe your architectural documentation is written in Markdown and committed to source control. Mm-hmm. I know that I've been doing that for about a year now, and it's been fantastic. But everything being version controlled and just having let's throw this in here. So say that you, within the cloud provider itself, you want to keep things cloud native, but for the vendor focused stuff, say that you have strategically deployed, you know, POPs around the United States, like Megaport or Equinix, you know, maybe you have three of them, West, mm-hmm. Central, and East. Maybe you put your vendor stuff in there and kind of tandem with your organizational strategy. So like right now, a lot of organizations or enterprises, they still backhaul like a lot of their stuff through a centralized data center to get to internet and to other things. Maybe as part of the strategy in deploying these colos, you have stuff, you know, coming back to the POP that's closer to your users. It's, you know, getting closer to the actual consumers that use these applications. So maybe they come in and they hit all of your vendor stuff. So you're used to Palo Alto, you're used to F5. You know, these are the networking vendors we're used to working with. We already do business with them. Maybe instead of deploying these directly in the cloud, we position them in colos and then have the connections up to the cloud. And then within the cloud, we keep it nice and clean with, you know, all the stuff that is exclusive to that cloud provider.
So let's take an example of then our VPN tunnel connectivity. Because by golly, I'm going to bring it back to this connectivity thing. So if I'm standing up a VPN tunnel, then like walk me through. I've got my on-premises stuff. I've got a colo and I've got public cloud. Stitch that together for me using the IPsec tunnel methodology, or at least, you know, give me some link in the chain where you think IPsec might be appropriate, and then what the two endpoints look like. Is one side, if one side's cloud native, and what that looks like.
So let's see. So, to go back to one of your, I think you asked what was like a pro and con of using a VPN. I don't think I answered that.
Well, we didn't. And I'm actually curious to hear your answer, because my take has always been, you throw it up as the quick and dirty, but you're going to probably want to replace it with something better eventually. But anyway, yeah, let me get your take on it.
Yeah. I mean, so like we talked about them being easy to set up, and, you know, you probably already have like large internet circuits and hardware available on a DC, you know, traffic is encrypted, which I don't know if that's a pro or a con. I guess it can be both, because your direct connect traffic's not going to be encrypted. You know, really anything that talks, I mean, I know that each cloud provider, they'll have like an approved list of gear that they'll provide like templates for and help you with the configuration. So, you know, but really anything with IPsec, you know, BGP over IPsec can work. Like I've used just in testing like pfSense with, you know, IPsec and running OpenBGP over it to connect to, I think, all big three public cloud providers. So pretty simple. If you can do IPsec and BGP, you can, you know, stand up that VPN. I think the SLAs are going to differ quite a bit. So from, I mean, this is also important too, because your business resiliency and operational readiness. I know most places I've worked, like SLA is critical. You have to have something, you know, maybe it's got to be documented. And with the VPN, you're not going to get that SLA, you know, because it's going over the public internet. That's an issue. And so with the throughput stuff, you know, thinking about throughput in general, like if you have a strategy to either move data to the cloud, you know, because, you know, data gravity is a serious thing. Large data sets are pretty hard to move and, you know, applications want to be closer to that data. So if you do intend on using the cloud and you have workloads on premises, you know, it's always good to think about like how you're going to move that data along with the application or the connectivity between the data and the application. Is it going to be quick enough? You know, that high throughput, you know, and the low latency definitely drives data gravity. And then thinking about too, the, not to sidetrack again, but like AWS has a service, what is it? Snowmobile is what it is, you know, which basically they'll back in a data center on a semi truck and, you know, to your data center. And you can basically, I think it's like up to like 100 petabytes of data per truck. I might be wrong about that, but it's like, you know, it's a data center on wheels. You know, that helps you get your data to the public cloud provider itself. Well, think about how long it would take. I mean, 100 petabytes of data, if you tried to transfer that over a dedicated 1 gig or even like a 10 gig connection. I mean, I don't know how long it would take. I haven't actually...
comically long. I mean, long enough that Amazon has a service where they bring a truck because it just ain't going to happen if you try to do it over the wire, right?
Yeah, it might be a few years. So that's, you know, also a thing, because your VPN is not going to be like, you're going to be using your internet for other stuff, probably. So it's not going to be dedicated just for your connection to the cloud, whereas, you know, a direct connection is most likely.
Yeah, it's funny, a comment you made earlier about VPN, like, I don't know if encryption is a, you know, a pro or a con, and some people are going, well, of course, it's got to be encrypted. Yeah, but that really depends a lot on the nature of the application that's going over that tunnel. If it's already encrypted and you're encrypting it again, that's a thing. That's a performance penalty, potentially, that you're dealing with there. And why are you re-encrypting it if at an application level it's already encrypted? And then the answer could be because William is running BGP in the tunnel. I heard him say it, and, you know, and so on. Okay. You know, all fair enough, but it is interesting that, you know, do I actually want to encrypt this traffic if I don't have to? And then if I move it over to a direct connect, which to me is a private circuit effectively, correct me if I'm wrong there, William, but that's my understanding of what I'm really getting there. It's effectively a private circuit into the cloud. Encryption from a privacy standpoint is less of a concern versus using the public internet as a transport.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. By nature, like AWS has Direct Connect, Microsoft ExpressRoute, and Google Interconnect, and each one of these is going to come in layer two on encrypted fashion. Yeah, and it's basically a private, dedicated, you know, connection between your facility or your data center to the cloud provider. And then there's a few options. There's a few caveats to that statement because, you know, not all direct connects and express route circuits are created equal, you know, so they give you a few ways to do this. You can either do it, you know, via a, like a partner connection, or you can do it in, you know, true dedicated fashion, you know, like one-to-one, like your network to their network, you know, whereas with the partner connection, you're going to have to go through a service provider of some sort, like an AT&T or CenturyLink.
Yeah, where they can make that direct connect be, like if you're already an MPLS customer of theirs, they could actually bring that circuit into your private MPLS cloud that you've bought from them.
Yeah, it's really simple. I've done it that way also. Like if you leverage AT&T for MPLS, you know, they have NetBond and, you know, they basically have a a stand-up call and a portal that they give you access to, and you can go in and, you know, since you already have their service, you can set everything up. Pretty cool.
And what's the appeal of a Direct Connect or an Express Chat? Is it just about performance, or are there other benefits?
It's, yeah, mainly performance and flexibility, remaining vendor neutral, I guess, because if you go down the partner connection route, for sure, you know, you're going to want to do a few different vendors. Like maybe you do, you know, AT&T and Verizon, if those are your two providers that you already have. That just, in thinking of, I know one thing at one place that I worked, security sort of had this concern about, okay, if we do this partner connection, there's something that's like in between us and the cloud provider. So it doesn't just go from us to AWS or someone else in the middle.
Right.
And, you know, they didn't like that. So for that specific instance, you know, when we hashed out everything and went through both designs and went through the cost management and, you know, proved everything out, they said, hey, you know, okay, we want to spend the money for an actual physical Direct Connect and do it that way.
This sponsored break in our conversation is courtesy of INE.com, experts at making you an expert. INE is proud to announce the release of a new monthly All Access Pass subscription plan that provides users with unlimited access to their entire content library of over 14,000 training videos. This subscription plan is designed with the individual subscriber in mind. It's the same great content INE is known for, with payment options tailored to your needs. The All Access Pass allows IT professionals to continue expanding their skill set and stay up to date with the latest industry developments and information available. For $99 a month, users can take advantage of a wide variety of tools and services devised and curated by top experts in the field. INE is committed to the personal success of every user, from engineers looking to advance their careers to corporate teams aiming to strengthen projects with the best technology there is. The All Access Pass opens the door to hundreds of courses and thousands of videos covering an extensive range of topics, including networking, DevOps, security, development, data science, and general IT. All Access Pass subscribers can utilize unlimited streaming of over 14,000 training videos, free online classes, monthly webinars, an advanced progress tracking tool, and comprehensive workbooks. Users can learn more about the best technology being used today from those who know it best. INE's experts share their experiences and knowledge working with Cisco, AWS, CompTIA, Google, Java, and other top technologies. Subscribers can choose between a flexible monthly payment plan of $99 a month or secure their training for a whole year for $999. That's 2 months of access for free. Users on either plan can cancel at any time with no extra fee. INE can guide you in any direction you choose. It's never been easier to take that first step. Visit INE.com/packetpushers. One more time, that is INE.com/packetpushers. And now back to the show.
Now, from a cost perspective, we have more, you know, detail on the Direct Connect Express route, but I want to get this thing out of the way. From a cost perspective, if I'm standing up a VPN tunnel, just a basic IPsec tunnel, that I'm assuming is fairly cheap, maybe some data transfer costs. So what is the cost of that versus actually standing up a circuit, which I assume is more of a commitment from the business?
So a physical Direct Connect is going to be, it would be astronomically more expensive. So, I mean, you're just going to have the, with the VPN, the egress from the cloud provider that you're paying for, and then your internet throughput that you're paying for, which you're probably already paying for, and you just maybe aren't consuming.
Yeah.
But, you know, with the physical circuit deal, I mean, you've got to think about, you know, getting into in order to do a physical or a dedicated connection to each of the cloud providers, you know, all three of them, the big ones, you got to have a colo presence. So that means you got to pay for the space, you know, the power, the rack, you know, and, you know, all that's wrapped up into, you know, operational expense. But then you have to do the actual physical gear. You have to stand up if you're, you know, switching to terminate the layer two connections, you have to have something that can, you know, route those packets and, you know, meet any sort of, you know, the laundry list of requirements that you no doubt have from your security folks. You know, there's going to be a list. So having that segmentation with your routing, you know, making sure all your hardware can meet those requirements You basically have to build out a small data center or something to facilitate that high speed connection that you want to the cloud.
Right, because you have to go to a physical location where AWS or Azure or whatever has their locations that then tie into their public cloud services and get inside a cage and then connect to their cage.
Yep, absolutely. And then you have to think, how are you going to connect your, you know, not to add more expense on this, but, you know, how are you going to connect your traditional data centers to these CNFs? You know, you could probably use MPLS, but, you know, I've been in a few instances where risk averse companies that are attempting to do a large scale part of their strategy to shift to cloud. Now they want fast and dedicated, you know, so they want some sort of metro connections from their data centers to these CNFs. And, you know, even getting into the protected paths versus the unprotected, it almost makes sense to me to purchase like multiple unprotected paths that are diverse and, you know, assume that failure is going to happen on, you know, any number of them, but at least you know which one fails. And with the protected paths, sometimes it's like, okay, I'm sitting here and I don't know anything. I got to call my provider. I got to wait on the phone. I don't know what's going on. And, you know, it's, from an audit perspective, it can be kind of difficult because as a customer, you don't have the visibility. So it's not just building out all the stuff in the CNF. You got to connect to the CNF.
Okay. You've just said CNF four times now, and I'm feeling like an idiot over here because that's an acronym that I actually don't know what that means. What is a CNF?
A carrier neutral facility.
Oh, okay. Sure. I was like, cloud network frame? I don't think so. That doesn't sound right.
It's easier
carrier
to say
neutral
than,
facility.
Yeah, yeah. It's easier to say than colo or something, you know, colocated data center.
I get it now. It makes total sense. And actually, that's perfect to follow up with because I had another note here. You said, okay, so for a direct connection, I've got to be in a colo. But I mean, you can, via your service provider, get a direct connect to come into your on-premises facility, right?
Yeah. And you don't really have to provision, like the stuff that you provision if you go that route is going to be virtual. So, you know, you're basically going to get access to like if you're with AT&T, they're going to give you access to a new portal that is cloud focused and pretty simple to work with. Like you basically just have to go in and they'll have like a, I forget what AT&T calls it, but it's some sort of like virtual connection. I think it's virtual network connection in which you'll go in and, you know, you'll create the profile definition for your stuff. Like what kind of peering you're going to do. Is it public or private peering? Is it ASN numbers, IP address ranges, things like that. And you'll build that out. And then you'll have a separate VLAN profile that does the, you know, so it's a two-way sort of thing. It'll be your connection from your service to AT&T side of the house, and then from the, you know, Microsoft Azure to the provider service also. So the providers, you know, AT&T just sort of facilitates it on both ends. But on the flip side, there your SLA, you're going to have, you know, more SLAs, you know, because you're probably going to have something separate from the cloud provider itself to the service, and then, you know, from the service, which is probably under a separate SLA, then, you know, your MPLS services, obviously.
Yeah, you're piggybacking off of that service provider for the convenience of last mile connectivity that you presumably already have to your facility, as opposed to going into that colo facility that is extremely well plumbed and central from an internet perspective, and there's fiber coming in from all over the place, and is more of a direct shot from that CNF, see, I can say it now too, from that CNF up to the public cloud. So you're trading off convenience for a circuit that ultimately is less performant, probably higher latency, and as you said, has a different SLA profile than being in the colo, the CNF, and having that direct connection.
Exactly. Yeah, it's funny. One of the first times that I was in a meeting with, you know, one of these co-location providers, and, you know, there are securities in this meeting, networking's in this meeting, some like leadership, and the salesperson comes out and they're like, yeah, imagine if you're in our facility and you just have a bunch of, you know, cables and you're just throwing them over your cage into other cages. And then they're just taking those cables and plugging them into their gear. And you know, you could see like security's face just become longer and longer and longer. Like, wait, are you really throwing our cables over into other cages? You know, is that really how this works?
Oh my word. Have you ever been into a colo? Those of you out there who think we're making this up, that's exactly how it works in some of those facilities. I mean, there's not actual flinging involved. Well, there might be. You ever, you know, attached a cable to like a tennis ball with a piece of duct tape and thrown it to get the cable from, I'm not saying I've done that. I have done that. That's true. That's a thing that has happened. Anyway, yeah, kind of is that way. Now, yeah, there's some security that is built around it, but pretty much from that cage over there, that's locked up with some switch. Whoever the hands-on in the colo is going to plug a cable in and move it through basket, probably up overhead, and then drop it into your cage. And they're going to hand you off a piece of Ethernet cable that is labeled with a circuit identifier on it or something. And it's like, now you're ready to go plug it in. That really is what happens.
Yeah. With all the, you know, there's a lot of minute things that happen on the security front, you know, a lot of different approvals and, you know, different things, but yeah, that's at the end of the day, that's sort of what happens.
A lot of paperwork to get you to that point. Yeah.
Yeah. It's nice though, because I mean, if think about it this way, like if you have a presence in one of these big carrier neutral facilities, you're basically in the same building as a lot of people that you want to do business with. So if you want to go multi-cloud, you're there with Azure, you're there with GCP, you're there with AWS, you're there with Salesforce, you're there with WebEx, you're there with all these different services. You can also, you know, if, I don't know, like thinking about your strategy, like maybe there's other aspects of your networking strategy, you know, that you can enhance through this also. Like if you start, you know, say you're doing SD-WAN in tandem with, you know, cloud, you know, say that you have connections from your branch then back to the closest colo, and then you have internet out of that colo. So that way, you know, if you have one data center in, you know, North Carolina, but you have a lot of users out in California, you know, they're not traveling all the way back to, you know, North Carolina to get out the internet. You know, they're going to the closest colo and going out.
Okay, you just said a mouthful there implying about routing design though. And so I think we got to back up one step. Now, if I'm in the colo, and you said, right, we're there in the colo with all these other companies that I want to do business with, Azure and AWS, and I got confused because you said WebEx. I didn't know what you meant by that. And then all these other people that are in there. I was making a joke about WebEx. Sorry. your point being, you know, I plug in, and effectively all these people are my next door neighbors. They're all right here with me in the same building, but to be clear, we're not talking about an internet exchange as far as what I'm typically getting. I mean, you could do that, but that's not exactly what's happening here. I'm provisioning a circuit that connects me from my presence in the colo to specific services or a specific service that I am connecting to. It's not like I'm plugging into a switch and lights come on and angels sing, and all of a sudden I'm via an internet exchange kind of connection, all of a sudden directly adjacent to all of these other services.
Yeah, no, that's right. So, I mean, simply just connecting to AWS, say that you have, you know, you get into a colo and you just want to connect to AWS, you basically have to take care of the layer one. So you basically go in and, you know, from the AWS portal, you've got to, you know, set up and create a profile for like a direct connect. You have to download an LOA, and then you have to take that LOA back to the colo to say, hey, look, you know, we're authorized to do business, and I'm going to submit a request for you to connect me physically from my cage to AWS's cage. And then from there, you actually have to go in probably and submit another remote hands request to come in and patch, you know, into your physical gear. So that AWS connection is one, you know, an Ethernet port on your switch, you know, all the way back to, you know, AWS's side. It's a, you know, physical connection.
It's a physical connection limited to that one service. You've ordered that specifically. There was a lot of paperwork and sign-offs involved that specifically created this circuit, stood it up, and eventually got the physical cable run. And now you've got this connection from you to, in this example, AWS. And now it's up to you to use that wire and use that circuit to and move traffic across it. So, I mean, we're pushing 45 minutes into this conversation, William. We haven't said boo about routing or, you know, how to actually move traffic across these wires that we've built. So maybe we should move into that part of the conversation. So let's continue with this example. I'm in my colo. I have stood up this circuit, and It connects me from my cage to, again, the AWS cage. What do I have a routing protocol that I'm running? What does it look like just for this part of the link? There's more of the link we need to discuss, but just for this part of the link, is there peering happening? Explain to us how we begin to go down the road of moving traffic across that wire.
Yeah, so you got the layer one done. You know, you've terminated the layer two. It's coming into your switch. You know, you're gonna layer two's VLANs. So you have your VLAN set up for that specific connection, and you know, then you have to have something to route the packets. So, you know, BGP is definitely the go-to protocol for all this, and especially if you're trying to do multi-tenancy, you want to have separation between, you know, different segments, environments, maybe cloud providers, however your, you know, whatever your strategy is. So maybe I have a, you know, let's say a VRF for AWS production, a VRF for AWS development, you know, maybe a VRF for, you know, AWS, like let's say I want to use public VIF. So maybe I, you know, separate that into another VRF.
So you're talking VRF light here? Or are we talking full blown, you know, VRF with route targets and distinguishers, et cetera?
Oh yeah. Full blown VRFs. You're defining the targets, you're going in, you're setting up the adjacencies. And a lot of the, you know, some of the cloud providers I know have specific things that you have to configure within that VRF, some different, you know, maybe multi-hop stuff, just different criteria. I can't recall exactly, but I know that when I set up, when I did this with Google, you know, doing, you know, interconnect, they had some specific configuration stuff, you know, on the BGP end that was definitely specific to Google, you know, that differed from Microsoft and AWS.
In the form of like communities and these sorts of things that were unique, or just?
No, just custom configuration in general. Like in order for to get BGP up with the interconnect, I had to configure multi-hop or it wouldn't come up.
Okay, sure.
And, you know, that's something that, you know, I didn't look back at the, you know, when I was setting this up, I'm like, man, I've done this so many times. And I went through and I didn't actually read their specific documentation. And
because why would you?
Like, right? You know, why isn't this coming up? Like, it doesn't make any sense. Everything's right. I can, you know, I can ping across, you know, layer two's up. What's going on here? Yeah, it turns out that you should go back and read, you know, documentation when you do this stuff.
You're raining on my parade, man. Okay, so we're standing up BGP between now. Is this peering session between the colo switch router and then AWS or whoever the cloud provider is? Is that where the two ends are of this BGP session?
Yep, absolutely. So I guess in most documentation you'll read, you know, this would be like the customer router in quotes. You know, so this is maybe my Cisco ASR sitting in the colo that terminates my cloud connections, you know, and does the routing. So from, you know, on there, you know, I define my route targets. I set up my VRFs. I set up all my peering, and maybe depending on the criteria. So, you know, public and private peering are treated very differently. So maybe downstream, I have a set of firewalls. Like maybe I have some ASAs that are multi-context, or maybe some Palo Altos, and I have virtual firewalls set up. And, you know, maybe I route, you know, maybe I have BGP set up on the firewalls as well. So I'm routing between these VRFs that are segmented down to, you know, I have BGP turned on for a specific context, and I'm, you know, routing via BGP down to the firewalls. I know one environment I came into, it was interesting because they had BGP turned on to the cloud providers, but they had these, well, first of all, kind of a funny story, but they were setting up VRFs on the ASRs to match all the VPCs that they created in AWS. So if you're in cloud, you know, your developers, they're going to, you know, you're going to have a ton of VPCs. So what it turned into is we had a ton of VRFs. You know, because they were creating a VRF per VPC. You know, and this does not scale well. It's just not a good idea. And on top of that, we had some firewalls that, I mean, they were BGP capable, but in routing the traffic from that point in the colo back to, you know, so the traffic knew how to get back to the traditional environment, they were using static routes for everything. So,
oh, fun.
Coming in, it's, yeah, so you can see how much config sprawl this, you know, kind of thing would generate. So, you know, having that strategy in place for the cloud and having your, like, knowing what segmentation is actually required from your security compliance and, you know, all the powers that be, you know, how do you need to segment, you know, because you want to, I guess segmentation is a funny thing because it can add unneeded complexity, and that complexity can lead to operational challenges like, you know, 100 VRFs.
Well, I mean, there's different ways to do it. You could use the circuit as kind of just a funnel that carries all the traffic in and then let the cloud security model handle traffic between VPCs. You could use transit gateway. You could build a hub and spoke VPC topology and control traffic flowing between VPCs through that central one. There's different ways you could kind of get the same result if you wanted. I mean, but if you're already married to a VRF model, like that's, I'm making a guess here, William, that that's how your central data centers were, your on-premises data centers were already segmented as VRFs, and effectively you're extending that model all the way up into the cloud?
Well, so kind of, that's twofold, because you have, say that your, you know, cloud strategy, when we talked about maturity and, you know, getting to that point where identity and access management, you know, you're attaining that zero trust and you really have a, like your security folks more specifically have the staffing and have the skills to go in and, you know, they're getting everything they need from the compliance perspective. They understand exactly what's going on. And the strategy is actually matured in a way that meets all these requirements. But if you're not at that point yet with your cloud strategy, then you have to basically nail down those requirements somewhere else, which always, you know, seems to be the network. So
I was just going to say, we're fixing it in the network again. Dang it.
This is, yeah. There you can fix a lot of things in the network, apparently.
We'll be back to this podcast shortly, but we're going to talk about ExtraHop, a packet pusher sponsor, first. Your job probably includes managing applications, network infrastructure, and so on. But how do you do that when you can't even see everything those apps are running on, when half the network the app is running across isn't even yours? Add to that SDN changing things in automated ways that maybe feel out of your control, or devs and other business units firing up their own cloud instances and then expecting you to support it even though you've got zero instrumentation. These scenarios are some of the ways that ExtraHop can help. ExtraHop is a leader in network analytics, and they help you consolidate tools into their analytics platform and make sense of application performance running over infrastructure that's sprawled beyond your data center and across the internet and then into the cloud. ExtraHop offers complete visibility and leverages machine learning to help you make sense of the mountain of metadata about your network. And in the end, you can make informed decisions about your IT stack and do it quickly. If you go to extrahop.com/packetpushers, you can find out more about the ExtraHop performance platform. Once more, that is extrahop.com/packetpushers. And now back to the show. Talk to me about the circuit going the other way. So we've got connectivity from the colo up to the cloud. In your example, we're talking about VRS with route targets and distinguishers and using BGP to carry segmented traffic between the colo facility and the various VPCs in a secured way because we've segmented the traffic like that. But is there also then traffic that's being backhauled back into an on-premises location? And if so, what does that circuit look like? And what IP blocks are getting announced to who from where? Which is a pretty loaded question, but, you know, help us flesh out the rest of the connectivity.
Well, as far as like advertisements from your environment to the cloud itself, you know, I've always thought, you know, it's a good idea to push that policy as close to the edge as possible. So maybe within those VRFs, like maybe you have, so like maybe Microsoft Azure, I have a /16 for East and a /16 for West. And maybe, you know, in that VRF, I have, you know, I have these prefix lists that are defining my traffic. And then I have like route maps that are, you know, filtering inbound and outbound stuff, you know, so that's there. So as far as the traffic that's coming back to my traditional environment, BGP communities are a good thing here. I think, you know, prefixes can be classified in many different ways. And, you know, based on a design, like having different views into your BGP table is, you know, infinitely useful for the people that speak network. So I would say that when you think about BGP communities and maybe designing a certain framework or a system around them, you know, you want it to be simple, flexible, and you want visibility into, you know, especially if you have a multi-tenant environment, you want visibility into things, you know, all the things. Something that was kind of interesting that I did at one point was there's a lot of different values that can be added to a single BGP prefix. So based on like just in the past, like when I started doing network engineering, you know, I kind of thought that, okay, a requirement for these BGP communities is I have to use my organization's AS number on the left side. And on the right side, I've got to use something like a VLAN or just like one thing that can be used for identification. And kind of, you know, thinking about this further, especially if you say that you want to do eBGP within your own environment, like on a hop-to-hop basis, taking the communities and using the left and the right side for things, like maybe building a sequential numbering system. So something that I did was having like an identifier for like link function. Like that would be, you know, whether something was learned from the primary or secondary peer, a DC origin. So like where did a prefix originate from? So, you know, being able to look at that and say, okay, well that originated from like Ashburn or Silicon Valley or Chicago. Maybe VRF ID, maybe a number identifier for like cloud affiliation. So, and looking at that in the routing table, I can see, hey, this prefix originated from Azure. So building this into a sort of system for communities, like the left side being like maybe type and the right side being value, it just allowed for just enhanced view into the routing table.
So if you're not, okay, it sounds like you're using communities then as metadata to attach to a particular prefix, your own custom system. You're taking the community field, you're breaking it out into this, you know, left and right side, as you were describing, to define a couple of different things. And if you don't need communities, well, no, you can really do whatever you want. You can just use that again as your own custom metadata field. So now you have the advantage of looking at a BGP table on a device, seeing all the communities that are task-specific prefixes and knowing, how did these show up in my table here, in my BGP table? Where did they come from? Which, when you have something as complex as what you're describing, especially with all the different VRFs, should be infinitely valuable in troubleshooting.
Yeah, and even being able to define certain specific use cases or types of traffic that I want to allow back in, you know, so say I have some sort of like allowed routing policy based on community coming back into a data center, being able to like really granularly define things. So like if my left side is, if it's like a type, like a peer type, like maybe one is primary, secondary, two is equal to data center origin, three is equal to like a VRF ID, and four is like cloud affiliation. And on the right side, for one, I obviously have a, you know, it's either a primary or a secondary peer probably, you know, and two can be like all my locations, all my colos, and maybe three is, you know, all my different cloud providers or future providers, you know, starting at one and like numbering up. Yeah. And like looking at a community, I can see a community value like 1-1, you know, would mean like, hey, I learned this from a primary link. And then the next value is maybe 2-2. Okay, this originated from this colo. And then the third one is, it's tagged as like an Azure or an AWS route. So yeah, using communities to both enforce the policy and, you know, use it to say what's allowed in back into my traditional infrastructure can be really useful.
I'm sitting here just smiling. This is beautiful. This is also a real pain in the rear end to maintain, William, and show other people how it works. But oh my gosh, it is that if you, when you get into that much complexity and need that kind of fine tuned control, that is that's kind of a glorious way to tag all those prefixes and be able to make decisions on whether or not to throw them in the route table or not,
so et cetera. The reason that for is, this was actually, cool, I was man. Thinking about this from the perspective of automating. So in automating, if I use my ASN on the left and then a VLAN on the right, well, in coming through and taking things out, say I'm not going to use that VLAN anymore, there's a lot of different places that I have to update to reclaim something in, you know, an automated fashion. So in doing this, since, you know, their number values sequentially 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, it's really easy to build into templates and to define things and adding new environments and saying what's allowed based on those environments and then removing environments and saying what I have to remove there. It makes it a lot easier. Understanding the system. Yeah. It's a lot of, you know, when I sort of like rolled this out, you know, one of the first things I did was I went and I had an all day sort of session with our network operations center to explain it, break it down, you know, go through it, you know, look at the value, you know, just getting, writing up some real documentation around it too, that really broke it down nicely. But from that point on, I mean, the point is, if you're looking into the routing table, and you know what the values are, if you have a cheat sheet, you know exactly what something is. Yep. But if you're doing configuration, like adding or removing, I want that to be automated, which was sort of the point of why I put all this together. It was fairly easy to build into some templates that I already had put together.
Oh man, you said automated, and we're like an hour into this recording already, and now we could talk for another hour. I'd love to get into that system a bit, but maybe at a high level, can you tell us what all was being automated? Of which I'm assuming what you're doing is standing up a new VRF to accommodate a new VPC that's being provisioned, something like that, or
one of the environments that I use this on when I came in, you know, I began, you know, by starting off by just going through and building out automation against, you know, what existed operationally at that time. And there's a point where you start to build out automation and you think, okay, it's more trouble and it's more work to build out the automation because of certain design, I don't want to call them issues, but just design things that are just contrary to automation. So the main thing about automation is, you know, being very repeatable and, you know, making everything as cookie cutter as possible. So yeah, automation in this environment had to do with, you know, basically adding desired state for VLANs, you know, building out new VRFs, actually setting up the neighbor adjacencies and pulling, using something like NetBox to have a full database. Like say I have a /16 for this stuff, keeping track of what has been used and what hasn't been used, grabbing that next available out of my peering block, you know, setting up the peering, mm-hmm. going down and actually setting up for this environment specifically. I was using Ansible to create new firewall contexts, going in and, you know, doing all the initial onboarding for that firewall context, setting up the BGP from the firewall to upstream and downstream, and then coming down and, you know, doing the community stuff, ingress back to the data center. And then I'm trying to think of anything else I had to do there. I mean, I think that was the gist of it. Yeah, and then prefix list and route.
Yeah,
maps.
I mean, and that's a lot. I mean, it's complicated to set up that circuit effectively is what you're doing. And so you've automated the standup of it. You mentioned NetBox along the way. I want to throw out for the listeners, if you don't know what NetBox is, we did a whole show on using NetBox as a source of networking truth, which was Heavy Networking episode 452. We did that with John Anderson. He was one of the NetBox major contributors, talked to us about that. And it sounds like that's exactly what you were doing with it, William, using it as a source of truth for IP addresses as you stood up the circuits and, you know, needed to set a peering and, you know, and so on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So I'm talking to you who has maybe one of the most complex networking requirements to connect from your colo facility up into the public cloud and then, you know, back down to your on-premises data centers as well. So this has been, you know, quite an education. You've gotten into it as deeply as I think could be imagined. But what you've ended up with then, you know, is an automated system where across a direct connector and express route service, you can stand up a BGP relationship with a VRF and announce all the appropriate routes, you know, announce it into the public cloud and announce on the reverse side back into your own, the network that you own as well. I think we could summarize it that way. So let me ask you one, you know, a couple of, you know, overall design challenge questions. One of the issues I've heard a number of people describe relating to direct connect or express route circuits is asymmetric routing, where there is a public face very often to these public cloud resources. And so sometimes you're sending traffic in via the direct connect, but it's coming back out across the internet, or the opposite might be true. Have you had any challenges that way? Are there any special concerns that you would raise for the audience who have maybe heard about that kind of a problem?
Yeah, I mean, the main thing there, so that's going to be with like your public VIFs and your public peering, or not public peering anymore, Microsoft peering with Azure. I would say that the traffic destined up to Microsoft through public peering, you know, that you wanted to take express route, you know, you're going to have to use local preference. There's going to be a lot of local preference there to influence that. And then, you know, you just have to make sure that, you know, when you're mixing stuff, you know, you really want to avoid that, you know, suboptimal routing, obviously. So if you have...
So using the BGP attribute of local pref to make sure that traffic ends up being enforced symmetrically, that it's not naturally attracted to go out the internet when it shouldn't be, so that you're getting everything to and from. Okay, so you're ending up with effectively treating this as one large BGP AS and treating it accordingly. In other words, it feels like every other routing scenario that's out there, it isn't mystical or something just because it's public cloud. It's still BGP.
Yeah, it's still BGP. And I mean, I would say that, like, I think I probably should read the documentation, but I think across like the public cloud providers, they want you to use, you know, routing preference a lot of times and, you know, maximize your route advertisement. So if you, basically the idea of it is if you don't know which, so for public peering, for instance, they're going to be advertising, so, you know, to say that, hey, I'm east or hey, I'm west. So if you don't know which prefix is for which region, because you have a whole WAN that has two express routes from east and west up to Microsoft's Azure, you know, so if you don't know which prefix is for which region, you know, that can obviously be a problem. You know, you can't handle events like you would want to. So, you know, route advertisements go into that stuff too. You know, I know one big thing that I had a problem with just when I first started, I think it was actually when I was using VPNs, when I stood up more than one VPN, was just the idea of, like, you know, from VPN A in one facility or VPN B in the other facility up to the cloud provider is, you know, advertising like a summary route for the both of them, and then, you know, advertising more specific routes, you know, that way, you know, if something goes down, like if my A side goes down, then it's going to just, you know, use that summary route to go back to the B side, you know, and it's pretty seamless, you know, and I'm not having to prepend anything.
Yeah, a pretty standard approach for some public facing. If it was back in the day and you were just announcing, well, back in the day, you still do that today, but you know, you've got your own provider independent space and but a couple of different data centers and you want it to primary to one. Sure, you announce aggregate. So if the more specific route disappears because that intended primary facility goes away, it's just going to fail over to the opposite yep. facility. Again, it's still just routing at the end of the day, and all the design attributes with some of your clever twists apply here. So but there is some unique limitations, I guess, per public cloud. Like, for example, if you've got I don't know, 50,000 routes in your BGP routing table internally, and that's not a big deal at all. It is a big deal if you were to try to dump that entire 50,000 route BGP advertisements up there. You can't actually do that, right? You got some limitations.
You're absolutely right. So I'm using like aggregates on the VRF and built like something that, so I got a story about that. On my anniversary, my wife and I went down to Biltmore. And we were touring, and, you know, going through the gardens. We had this nice little dinner, and it was going really good, you know, really enjoying myself. And I got a phone call, and AWS is down for everything. And I'm like, what? How can this be? And what had happened is, you know, the way we were filtering things, we weren't filtering at like the like a host route level. And we had something going on in one of the data centers where they advertised a bunch of host routes. You know, they were doing some, I don't know what they were doing, something around a software-defined data center change or something or another. And, you know, anyway, somehow a bunch of host routes got advertised up, slid through, you know, sent the route limit over for the direct connect and, you know, took AWS down for everything. You know, I can't remember what the route limit is now. I think it's like 400 or something. That could be wrong. Somewhere around there. But yeah, it was interesting because every other outage that like we had operationally faced had something to do with within the cloud provider itself. They made some sort of change or, you know, something happened, you know, that caused something. But it was that the outage was only specific to like maybe a service in a VPC or, you know, something that they could pin down, but this just wiped everything out. Yeah, it was fun.
So it's your solution then is largely aggregates. You're going to knock down those more specific routes that are, you don't even have to think too hard about it because even little routers can handle a fairly large number of routes these days. You do aggregates and make sure that you're under the limit and still showing them everything that that you need to show them, obviously. Which, although, I mean, if your IP numbering scheme wasn't designed and it just sort of happened, could actually be kind of tricky if you're a really large organization, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. For sure. Another thing, getting back to so I know we were talking about public peering and asymmetric routing and stuff. I was just kind of thinking, you know, I mean, I don't know if this is standard, but I'll just say that I've seen it a lot where an organization or an enterprise will use like publicly routable address space within their own internal network. And that's that can become interesting as well.
I mean, I thought IPv6 was just going to fix all of these sorts of problems.
False.
Yeah? No, not so much. Oh, man, we're going on a long time here, William, and I know we got to hit the wrap soon. But I did have one more question, and that is redundancy design. You know, that is any sort of WAN server design, LAN design. Redundancy is always, yeah, I'm assuming this thing's going to die and I'm going to fail over to something else. With WAN, it tends to be a little bit more costly. So a lot of redundancy designs, particularly there's a budget constraint, you might do something like, I'm going to fail over to an IPsec tunnel. I'm going to fail over to whatever it is that doesn't cost so much. Do you have a rule of thumb for redundancy design, how you've handled it in these scenarios? Does the complexity of your particular BGP design introduce more challenges with the redundancy? Or at the end of the day, is it still routing? Give us the insights.
It's still routing. I mean, I think in a past life, I had a direct connect in a, you know, IPsec backup. And then, I mean, that's pretty easy because it's always going to prefer direct connect first, unless it's down. That wasn't so much of a challenge. I think in the biggest thing that I've ran into in the environments that I've been in lately is up until a certain point with some of the cloud providers, I know Express Route specifically, if you created an Express Route circuit, it wouldn't automatically turn on BFD. You know, so it would use a lot of the default times. So basically, you know, BFD has to be configured on both sides for something to fail over. And, you know, when failing over with BFD compared to anything else, it's quite a bit quicker. I mean, you're basically just, it's probably 15 millisecond or less. You know, you're I mean, I guess as quickly as it takes like a router to, you know, empty and repopulate the fib and then, you know, start routing again, you know, it's fairly quick.
Yeah, a lot more quick than waiting for adjacency timers to say, oh, I guess he's not there anymore, and then fail over. Right.
So, I mean, I would look for the gotchas there, you know, when you're, that's why I think the networking folks should definitely be involved with, you know, setting up and provisioning these things on the cloud side, because little things like that, if you're a full stack developer and you're like, BFD, I wonder if that costs more. Nah, I'm just not going to click it. And then you know, go on and, you know, this is a critical circuit that, you know, if it goes down and there's failover, you know, you want that failover to be quick. You know, it's something that could have been avoided. Yeah, I mean, it's still the redundancy thing, the BGP thing, local preference, you know, communities, you know, all BGP in its glory.
In its glory, indeed. You've checked, you've hit almost all of the boxes for BGP, at least a lot of the core functionality of BGP. It was, as we're getting to the wrap here, William, can you recommend training resources? Or, I mean, how did you get your head around this? You've mentioned documentation a lot and even scolded yourself for not reading documentation in certain circumstances. Has that been, you know, good enough, or did you go to a class or read a book? Anything you'd recommend for folks that are standing up circuits to their hybrid cloud?
Well, I mean, my situation specifically, I made a decision quite a while back that I just wanted to get out of networking. I'm like, I don't want to do networking anymore. I want to get into cloud and automation only. And so I went like all in, man, trying to, you know, I got, you know, I had been in a few AWS environments. So I got the foundation cert, and then I went on and I took, I think it was a cloud guru, along with just going through each of these cloud providers has fantastic documentation. I mean, they're all really good. I mean, they're better than a lot of the stuff that you'll find out there on the web. Yeah, I've also done some Linux Academy stuff, and that has been fantastic because in Linux Academy, they have these cloud sandbox environments where you can basically get in and stand up whatever you want. You know, I can put a public IP on something and connect from my house. I can basically set up anything I want to set up within, you know, it's on the lower end of everything, obviously, because it's a sandbox environment. But practice by doing is the only thing that's going to really hammer this in. You know, if you're just reading books, it's not probably not going to be good enough. I would say that actually reading books in tandem with, you know, practical, you know, practice is a good way to go.
Yeah. You were just really encouraging when you say that the cloud provider documentation is very good. I've dug into a little bit here and there and been pleasantly surprised that, oh, this is getting up there towards Cisco quality, where it's actually, well, some of the Cisco stuff is hit or miss, but there is a lot of, particularly in the core routing realm with the Cisco documentation, it's kind of been the reference for a very long time, the standard to go by for docs, you know, quite thorough and usually gives you enough context. So you have some clue why you'd use a feature or not. So to hear that the cloud providers are also doing well with their documentation is encouraging. I've only been dabbling. I haven't had a chance to really get in too heavily like you and some other folks have. So that's encouraging. But I think you said something else there that's interesting, which is you had said, I'm getting out of networking and I'm going to go, you know, this whole, you know, cloud route, and began, you know, digging deeply. So if I am a networking practitioner, maybe I don't even want to get out of networking, but what you're implying, if I dig deeply on cloud and understand what's going on there, it's going to dovetail nicely with my networking knowledge. It's kind of been the context of this whole show. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it really enhances everything for you. And I mean, just to show that, like, that was my plan and it definitely didn't happen, because wherever I go, it seems like networking is always a challenge. And, you know, if you've got practical knowledge around the space, you end up getting sucked in and you get kind of stuck there. But yeah, I mean, it definitely enhances your knowledge because, you know, just to use an example, programmers are a dime a dozen, developers, a dime a dozen, you know, there's, you know, very good programmers. But if you take someone that isn't a programmer by trade, so if you take like a network engineer and you can program and you understand the difference between like programming and infrastructure, you know, true infrastructure as code, like, you know, your desired state versus config management, you know, immutable, and you can, you know, apply some of these practices, being a network engineer, That's really valuable.
Yeah, I've heard Russ White say something very similar. He's made the point that programming is nice, but it's a tool. What do you want to do with the tool? And if you're a network engineer, you're someone who has deep knowledge on how networking is supposed to work, then program can be a tool that you apply to that discipline, and you can make some really interesting things happen, kind of a corollary to what you were just saying.
Yeah, absolutely. And getting into some of the, you know, not even that you necessarily have to program, because really Terraform, Ansible, I mean, yeah, they use little languages to do things, but it's not, and there is some programming logic in there, but you're not necessarily programming, I don't think. So even like using those tools and finding out, sandboxing them and finding out efficient ways that they can solve, you know, problems that you're dealing with is just, it's fantastic if you can spend the time there and do that.
You can reduce a lot of that stuff down to it's templating plus logic. You can really simplify it down to just those two and understanding how the tool does what it does, which again, there's a whole other set of shows that we could go into there. Well, we better wrap it here, man. We're coming up on the time we had a lot, and I want to respect your schedule. Do you have a blog, a book, a Twitter handle, anything like that that you would like to promote? Now's your big chance.
I'm not really on much. I'm on Twitter. I don't really tweet that much. W Collins 502, and then LinkedIn, William-Collins. That's about it.
Well, very good. Well, man, thanks for raising your hand and sharing your knowledge here. This has been fantastic. And I know we were already talking about doing a Day 2 Cloud show with you on at least one more topic. And so I'm looking forward to having that conversation. Thanks for taking the time today. This has been fantastic. And thanks to you for tuning in. If you have suggestions for future shows, if you'd like to be a guest because you've got some knowledge that you want to share, hey, we want to hear all about that stuff. You can tweet us at Packet Pushers. We've got a contact form on packetpushers.net if you'd like to reach out that way, or packetpushers@gmail.com is the way you can reach us. And we'll don't expect an instant response because, you know, my goodness, we're busy people on this side too, but we'll definitely give us a little bit of time, get back in touch with you and schedule something and make it happen. Last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.